to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 607. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm recording here from the Reformed Forum office slash studio in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm delighted to be back with some good friends we have with us. First, let me introduce to you Jeffrey C. Waddington, soon to be Stated Supply at a new place. Maybe Jeff can mention it. Jeff, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Yes, beginning the 8th of September, which is, what, 3 or 4 weeks away, I will begin the Stated Supply at Faith OPC in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania, in the central PA Presbytery, actually.
I'm going to have to reprogram my brain, because in the early days, we had you as teacher of the congregation in Ringo's, New Jersey. And I switched over to Stated Supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. And now we're flipping back to Stated Supply at Faith OP. So congratulations, Jeff. We wish you a good service there. And I know you'll work hard and work well filling the pulpit. So we also have with us, as you can see on camera, we have Will Wood, who's PhD candidate at Westminster Theological Seminary. But these days, he's all tied up and busy. He's assistant professor of Old Testament at RTS Atlanta. Welcome back, Will. It's good to see you.
Hey, thanks, Camden. Good to be back on again.
Yeah, we always love having you, and looking forward to another excellent conversation. Today, we're going to be speaking about the authorship of Isaiah and other critical issues relative to this massive and significant and important prophet. So that's going to lead us into a conversation of many things, but Will has lectured in class at the seminary on Isaiah, and we're going to be walking through a few of his notes, but talking about some contemporary issues and seeking to address matters so that we all can learn and grow and benefit from this important Old Testament scholarship. I was just reviewing some things just yesterday, even in preparation for this, and looking forward to conversing and having a conversation here on Isaiah. Well, before we do that, I got a few things to mention, as we always do. Don't want to go on too long. Last week's episode with Lane Tipton, we got going on the intro so long that it probably became its own episode. So I'll keep it short and sweet if I could, but we'd certainly want to mention to everybody the Reformed Forum Conference coming up October 12th. We have the pre-conference VIP dinner on the 11th. That's sold out. Thank you to all who have registered for that, and we look forward to having you, but there's still plenty of seats available October 12th. That's Saturday, October 12th, 2019, in case you happen to be listening to this many years down the road. We have our conference at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. Our topic is The Law is Spiritual, wherein we're looking at the biblical understanding of law and spirit as redemptive historical ages, and we're going to be focusing on several important biblical passages, namely 2 Corinthians 3, Galatians 3 and 4, Romans 7:14, from which the title comes, as well as Romans 8. So hopefully we look forward to exploring these themes with you. And in our time together, we'll all come to see, I think, the riches of God's glorious plan that has been revealed to us progressively from creation to consummation. It's very much the kind of theme that we like to probe and address here at Reformed Forum, and we're looking forward to that. Jeff's going to be speaking. Lane Tipton will be speaking. I'll be delivering an intro and outro. And no offense, Jeff or Lane, who's out there, but I think I'm probably most geared up for Glenn's conversation at the VIP dinner. He's going to be delivering that special seminar and developing some very interesting themes in terms of Old Testament worship and the sacrifices and ascending the mountain or the hill of the Lord, and looking at how the Holy Spirit is typified and active even in the offering of those Old Testament sacrifices, namely the burnt offering. So we'll whet the appetite there, and Lord willing, if that goes somewhere, maybe we'll see him publish something on the subject down the road. But for all who are signed up for the VIP dinner, come, and you can hear it yourself. For those who aren't able to come to the dinner, you can still come on Saturday and pick Glenn's brain. I'm sure he'd love to speak with you about the subject. So all of that's online at reformedforum.org/conference for that. Also, some of you may have seen, I sent an email out to our email list, and we encourage you to subscribe to that. You can get our email newsletter. I'm trying to do this once a month. We haven't been good in ages past of always sending the emails out. But now with some more focused time, looking at communicating more frequently with our email subscribers. But in our most recent email, we sent out a link to a promo video. Actually, it's kind of more of a recap video of our event down in Wimberley, Texas. I'm so thankful for James Lee and his video crew who put that video together. And we're looking forward to producing the video recordings of that conference into a Sunday school series. So we're getting really close to being completed with the video. And I'm working hard to develop all of the notes and try to develop a study guide and handouts for those lessons. We're still on target to getting that finished and making it available for purchase in the fall. But if you'd like to be the first to know when it is available, the easiest and most surefire way, other than visiting me at the office in Grays Lake every day, is to subscribe to the email newsletter. And you can do that just at the bottom of the main page at reformedforum.org. All right. I thought I contained myself there. So that's about as little as I can get away with and still be a responsible host and executive director. But let's fire off and get into Isaiah. We're talking about some important stuff. And look, people, sometimes we talk about these critical theories, especially on Voss Group, where Lane and I are working through Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. And we encounter all sorts of things regarding critical theories and critical approaches to the Bible, whether that's Old or New Testament eventually. And we start to think that these things are so far off that they really have nothing to do with our contemporary, you know, Reformed confessional circles. Yeah, we think, wow, these are just liberals who are out there, people who don't actually believe the Bible that hold views like this. So we're not here today, at least I'm not, maybe Jeff is, but I'm not here today to scare people away and just, shame people for holding various views. But we are here today to discuss especially these critical views of Isaiah and Isaiah's authorship, because I think people would be rather surprised at how many scholars even within NAEPARC circles might hold to views other than a single authorship by a man named Isaiah. That the book that we know as Isaiah was written by one person under the inspiration of the Spirit. There are many people that have other views on that. We're going to talk about those. And I hope situate that also within the context of the whole of Scripture and also with a proper understanding of inspiration and divine superintendence as it comes to not just the writing of the Bible, but it's also its formation canonically. So we'll get to some of that stuff. I don't promise we're going to go in depth on everything I just mentioned and just signing Will up for an enormous amount of material that he's unprepared to address. Nevertheless.
Well, we were talking before, the lecture in class took 9 hours and we only have 45 minutes. So additional material won't help all that much.
Right. And the more I talk, the less time you have. Our time constraints are artificial, but before we do start, there's a few things reading at least that I'd like to mention. Perhaps you were going to mention them already, Will, but number one, I have the commentary by E.J. Young on Isaiah. So even that's getting old, it's not useless. E.J. Young was a tremendous scholar. And if we could have more E.J. Youngs, I think we would be doing extremely well. So take a look at that for some scholarship. It might be a little dated at points, but his theological and biblical theological viewpoint is still rock solid. The other, look at this, Jeff. You know this? You know why I'm bringing this up, Jeff?
I do not remember. No.
Well, Jeff Waddington edited a book once for the audio people. This is my copy that he signed to me, so you can read. So when I'm dead and gone, this book maybe will be floating around in the used book market. No doubt Ryan Noah will find it and try to sell it to somebody. Anyway, I apologize to the audio people. I'm talking about the book Resurrection and Eschatology, Theology and Service of the Church. This was a Festschrift, essays written in honor of Richard B. Gaffin Jr., edited by no less than Lane G. Tipton and Jeff Waddington. So they were working on this when I arrived at Westminster as a young, wide-eyed student in the MDiv program, and the book came out in 2008. But there's a really significant chapter in here written by none other than, do you know what I'm talking about now, Jeff?
I feel embarrassed, and you knew this probably. You're thinking,
I did not.
That probably hasn't looked at the book.
I was not expecting this, but I'm pleasantly surprised. You've amused me this morning. So there's a chapter by G.K. Beale.
Yes, I do remember that.
Of course you do. The title of it, A Specific Problem Confronting the Authority of the Bible. Should the New Testament's claim that the prophet Isaiah wrote, and he puts Isaiah in quotation marks, wrote the whole book of Isaiah be taken at face value? It's on page 135. So, Will, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you what you think of that chapter, but...
Well, it's pretty much a condensing of his larger work in The Erosion of Inerrancy and Evangelicalism.
Yeah, right. Right.
So you can also go to that and see the same arguments in a more full manner.
And we have spoken with him about that book in a previous episode, long while back when I was on Sedgwick, Jeff. That's a long time ago.
Oh, that is a while ago.
That's where I was living when we started the program. So anyway, Will, start us off here. Let's give us a little bit of an introduction to the prophet Isaiah, an enormous prophet, not just in terms of his weight and importance and significance, but even just in terms of the amount of words that are in the Bible. No doubt many people see that, and then people take that 100 different ways, maybe 10,000 different ways. So could you just help us, orient us non-OT scholars to kind of what's going on in the field at the moment?
Yeah, a little bit. Just a word on the volume of material. I was having a little Christian Liberty time with a buddy of mine here in Atlanta, talking about his work in New Testament. He was possibly teaching an Acts and Romans course, and his complaint was, how do I cover all of this material? And my response was, your material doesn't even equal the book of Isaiah. Isaiah, right. 66 chapters. It's not even the longest one. Jeremiah actually has more words in it than Isaiah does. And on top of that, in terms of just scholarship, I'm fairly certain more has been written on the book of Isaiah than any other book of the Old Testament. Just trying to work on a paper in my PhD program on Isaiah 53 and an allusion I'm arguing for in Zephaniah 3 I remember sitting around me and I had probably 100 books just in stacks all around me on Isaiah 53 alone. Not even talking about the other expansive stuff on the book of Isaiah. So just covering the material would take a lifetime to cover it. And in terms of our particular discussion today, maybe we can start, why is this discussion so important? And then orient where Old Testament scholars are in terms of how they're approaching the Bible generally. With their critical schools. So in terms of, go to church on a Sunday and talk to a congregant, and you say, well, a lot of scholars believe that Isaiah did not write the entire book. They probably look at you a little bit funny and say, what on earth are you talking about? What do you mean? So in general, especially in our three OPC circles, the general assumption is among the pew that Isaiah wrote the book. So why is this such an important discussion for us to have, even on Reform Forum, where it's going out to maybe a more popular audience, a Christian in the pew who wants to hear these things. Well,
just for the record, I would like everyone to note, I want to record this in the minutes, that Will Wood said that Reform Forum and Christ the Center is a popular audience. I just want people to know
that's
that.
Interesting. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
continue. That's all, Mr. Moderator.
They're my type of people, I guess. lay level generally, all right. There's a good section of listeners that I know of that are lay level listeners, as well, of course, seminarians and then folks like ourselves.
Sure.
So I think this is important for them because talking about the authorship of Isaiah is really talking about the nature of how the Bible came into being. And Christianity as a religion is a religion of the book, right? We're a religion based on the text of Scripture. Westminster Confession, chapter 1, makes that abundantly clear. And so if you start questioning that foundation, then the rest of the household kind of begins to crumble and go down with it. like Dr. Beal talking about erosion. And so it's like if this pillar falls, then the rest of the house begins to erode and crumble down. And this happens in a number of surprising ways in terms of how critical scholarship gets down into the pew. Just about a year and a half ago, I was having a conversation with a non-Christian who is raised in the church. And the reason he left the church was because he had been introduced to a book by a guy named Richard Elliot Friedman entitled Who Wrote the Bible, which uses these critical views that we'll talk a little bit about today to argue for the non-Mosaic origins of the Pentateuch. And so when in his life he saw the authority of the Bible questioned, he immediately concluded that the faith of Christianity goes with it. And so he ended up leaving the church. Now, that sad story about a gentleman apostatizing is actually quite true. You know, if you lose the foundation of the Bible, then the rest of the faith goes with it. And it's so that's true on that level. So I think it's important that maybe this could be a good resource where if a pastor or someone has a congregant who maybe got something in their hands pertaining to this issue, or they heard it on some History Channel documentary or something, then they can say, hey, here's a link to this video. Watch it and let's talk about this. Because the view that Isaiah did not write the book that bears his name is by far the most prominent view among Old Testament scholars today. It's that way among pretty much all critical scholars, but it's even seeping into evangelical scholars. We'll talk a little bit later about some of these guys. Three of them come to mind that were professors at Fuller Seminary in the last century, wrote an Old Testament survey book where they very clearly articulate a view that Isaiah did not author the book. So it's present in a number of seminaries, even those that have an evangelical history, and it gets disseminated to the popular level as well. And even the average Christian knows that if their Bible is called into question, then their faith goes with it. So we need to kind of stand on the line and defend the authority and the inspiration and the inerrancy of the Bible. And this is one such place where we need to do that.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, in large measure, we're looking at several different issues. You know, we're speaking of authorship, but that also touches upon the doctrine of Scripture on what it is, how we are to approach it. What are some of the different schools of approach? Maybe if you can provide for us a range or a spectrum of ways in which we treat Isaiah, maybe from an inappropriate inspired view that Isaiah was literally just dropped out of the sky, written, or dictated. There's nothing wrong with dictation. Huge portions of Scripture are dictated. But we also understand that's not exclusively the means of inspiration, just verbal dictation. And then we have all the way on the other side that Isaiah perhaps is a community's reflection upon phenomena in their day-to-day life they couldn't explain. So what do we see, you know, just in broad strokes in terms of different approaches, and then perhaps maybe some of the classical schools of interpretation on the prophet?
Yeah, so let's counter maybe first those that might say Isaianic origins or Isaianic authorship and yet mean something a little bit different than what the biblical picture looks like. So one of the misconceptions that you mentioned is dictation, like the prophet had nothing to do with the authorship of the book. It's just he was enamored or, you know, some sort of encapsulated with some sort of word, and it just, you know, kind of funneled through him. Another one, which I think is a little bit more prominent, would be that an image that conjures up into the mind of someone somewhat innocently, where Isaiah in a single setting would have just sat down and wrote his book from beginning to end without any previous work going on with that, without any previous thing being incorporated into it or anything of this sort. And I mention that as a misconception because the book of Isaiah is actually fairly clear that his ministry encompassed about 4 decades. So his call to the prophetic ministry begins, you know, Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, which is about 740.
And it ends in the time of Hezekiah, somewhere around the time that Sennacherib and the Assyrians are invading Judah. So around 700.
Right.
So his ministry, his active ministry, when he would have been proclaiming these messages to the people of God, we shouldn't, you know, be averse to seeing him writing some of these things down and taking them, proclaiming them, and things like that. And so we have like a 40-year span of him actively doing these things. And it seems like in terms of how Isaiah would have composed his book, that it is a book composed after that long 40-year ministry. And then it is purposefully organized in light of a very particular way that he wants to proclaim his message and have it handed down from generation to generation after him. I say that's important because we see a few things in the book, like, for example, Isaiah chapter 1, where Isaiah chapter 1 begins with a superscription, Isaiah 1:1, and then we have another superscription in Isaiah 2:1. Why would that need to be the case? Well, I think a plausible scenario there is Isaiah, towards the end of his writing, going back and writing Isaiah 1 as an introduction to the rest of his book. And so Isaiah chapter 1, which is structured after a covenant lawsuit, actually introduces the content of the book. And we don't have to say that here's Isaiah, you know, sitting there with his pen, you know, writing everything forward in a single setting. In order to argue for Isaianic authorship of the book. Instead, it seems like at the end of his life, after this long four-year ministry, he sits down and then compiles this book that we have. And I think that's important because one of the proponents we'll talk about here in a minute ago of the critical schools is a diversity in word choice or in writing style and things like that. And I don't know about you, I've only been writing in terms of academic work for the past about 7 years or so. And even in that time, my writing style has changed. My vocabulary differs. And so some of these differences, I think, can be reflective of a 40-year ministry being gathered together at the end of his life rather than some sort of long, multi-hundred-year process. So I think if we see it a little bit differently, in terms of Isaiah not... sitting down in one sitting and all of a sudden all this book comes out, but this long process over the course of his entire life being compiled ultimately at the end of his life, and that helps resolve a lot of these issues. And by the way, I would add, this is how all of us write anyway. There hasn't been a paper that I've written that I haven't written the introduction last.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, and even in my dissertation I'm working on now, I'll have multiple parts working at the same time. I have a chapter I'm working on, a chapter kind of on simmer, one that I'm doing some research looking forward to, and then I have a blank document that says introduction. And I think we can see that in terms of a base analogy for Isaiah's own writing, where he would have written and produced during his life, and then at the end of it kind of brought all of these things together into the one coherent book that we have today. We can talk about Jeremiah as evidence for that sort of thing in another episode, because actually the book of Jeremiah provides the most evidence that we have for how biblical books in the Old Testament are compiled. Some very explicit verses in there. Now let's take that and kind of juxtapose it to what some of these critical scholars do. These critical scholars look at different things within the book, and they begin to argue that the book of Isaiah is something not compiled by this prophet over a course of his 40-year ministry, but instead is a book compiled over the course of a number of centuries. Depending on the scholar, there might be this original Isaiah back in the 8th century, 740, but the final version of the book is most often attributed to the Hellenistic era. So you're talking about a 400-year or so difference there. And different phases and different time periods for the conclusion are proposed by different scholars. But the viewpoint is that what the book of Isaiah reflects is not a ministry of the prophet of the Lord proclaiming the word of the Lord to his people. But what the book of Isaiah reflects is the growing concerns of a believing community over the course of centuries. And I think that's a very important point to begin, because what that does is it actually flips our notion of what the Bible is on its head. So the Christian notion, the Reformed Orthodox notion of what the Bible is that it is a God's word given to his people as an infallible rule for faith and life. The critical conception of what the Bible is that it is a reflection of human culture or society, right? So it's not God's word given from God through a prophet to his people, but it is a reflection of a human culture. And so from the outset, we kind of have to note that the views of the Bible between the Christian conception and the critical conception are fundamentally opposite of one another. The origins of the prophetic message is completely opposite of one another. And so that's an important starting point for us. And in terms of other presuppositions, there's kind of four broad things that when I'm lecturing to my students that I mention. And those four things are historicism, human autonomy, philosophical positivism, and naturalism. And so maybe we can review those a little bit. Here, you two are some ST chaps, so I know you know the philosophical things even better than I do.
Yeah, that's all we care about. We don't even read the Bible.
Right.
Yeah, I mean that in terms of you're far more read on these things than I.
You see, in the academy, we're not even supposed to be talking to you, Will.
That's right.
That's true.
There's this dividing wall between systematics and biblical studies. Anyway, I'd love to go through some of those different fields. So yeah, let's walk through them.
Yeah. So just really briefly, I want to do this because I think we need to make clear that the presuppositions of the critical school are antithetical to Reformed Orthodoxy. All right. Anyway, we just need to make that clear as we're kind of going through these things. So one of those historicism. To start out, it's not saying, hey, things are historical. We all know that. We all agree on that. Historicism would say that the way history works is a pure cause and effect. There is no superintention to history. There's no divine providence. There's not even a created order. It's just simple cause and effect throughout history. And in terms of biblical writing, notice again, what that does is it cuts off the ability for God to intervene into history. I know you're going through Voss Group. One of Voss's key axioms is that word and deed revelation go side by side. If history is just a simple humanistic cause and effect, then the deed revelation that the Lord does as he comes to redeem his people is completely cut off. And if you cut that off, so goes with it the word revelation as well.
Say the historicism, in addition to cause and effect or related to it, is that it's purely human cause and effect, either individual humans or humans as a group, right? Culture, society, religion.
Yeah.
So that it's fully explained, at least in theory, it's fully explainable in purely human terms, and you are right. There's no divine causation. That's out of the question.
Yeah, completely out of the question.
For historicism.
Yeah, and this reflects what I was mentioning earlier in the way that they view the Bible, because the way they view the Bible is just simply a social historical artifact, right? The Bible simply reflects that historical progression. So they cut off divine intervention and along with that cut off divine revelation. Right. Positivism is another important one. I skipped one, but I'll get to human autonomy later. Positivism and what it does is it has a particular view of history that is carried over into the history of religion school, which is kind of the backdrop for these critical views of Isaianic authorship. And so just to use one example, August Comte, C-O-M-T-E, he produces a work where he argues that the way history progresses is from the most ancient form, which is fetishism, worship of inanimate objects, trees, rocks, birds, so on and so forth. That eventually progresses into polytheism, where gods are in charge of these things. Eventually, polytheism progresses into monotheism, the belief in one god. And there's another important element there, monolatricism, you know, the worship of one god while you're believing in other gods. And then eventually that progresses. In general, you know, we kind of stop there in our consideration, but the other part that's important is for Comte, that still progresses forward a little bit more from monotheism, religion, to philosophy and its discussion of metaphysics, and eventually to what he sees as the golden age of human reason, which would be his time, which was late 18th, early 19th century, which would be the scientific era, the empirico-scientific era. And the whole point that he wants to do in illustrating this progression is that in his era, he can shrug off the religious, theological, philosophical considerations of the past. And now finally, he can engage, humanity can engage any field within a context of their own empirical scientific investigation. And coupled with this is an articulation of human autonomy, where we can do it by our own cognition or our own will without any consideration of the Lord, as well as a belief in the way that humanity works. So if you're reading through things like these treatments of the prophets like Bernard Doom and these other guys, they actually hold to this view of the Old Testament, where the patriarchs, for example, are articulating fetishism. Abraham meets God at the Oaks of Mamre. They would say that that is a example of fetishism. And for them, and the importance for Isaiah, is that it's not until the 8th century, or really the time of Josiah, that monotheism becomes a thing. So for them, the prophets create monotheism, ethical monotheism in these things. So that produces yet another different view of what the prophets are. Right. Because from that view, the prophets become actually one of two very different things. On the one hand, some of these critical scholars would argue that what the prophets are, are religious geniuses who create monotheism to advance human culture. And on the other hand, a number of scholars who would have very similar views of the origins of Isaiah would say that the prophets are actually irrational enthusiasts who have these ecstatic mantic utterances. So it's actually quite remarkable to watch some of the way this progression in history works in terms of what the prophets are, what they do, and then how that relates to the origins of the book of Isaiah, because you almost have this rational, irrational dialectic, you could say, in the way that they see the prophets themselves. On the one hand, there are these great religious geniuses who create monotheism, create ethics. And on the other hand, there are these irrational enthusiasts who have psychotic dreams like a chariot throne in Ezekiel 1-3 or things like that. And so this kind of sets the context for what's going on here. And finally, the last aspect, naturalism. And the best way to summarize naturalism is anti-supernaturalism. From the outset, these critical scholars believe that either God does not exist, or even if he does exist, he's inaccessible and unknowable. He certainly can't intervene in history. It's historicism again, but in a more explicit frontier. So they reject the supernatural from the outright. And I think it's important we recognize these things, because these critical scholars, you know, the full critical scholars, not the evangelicals that appropriate some of their conclusions, but the full critical scholars openly hold to these things. It's not a secret to them. For example, I was just reading a book by Alexander Roth on the composition of the Pentateuch. And he says in the second paragraph that as he's approaching the Pentateuch, he wants to examine these things from the most natural perspective possible. And he proposes a possible dialogue with someone saying, but isn't the Bible supernatural? And his response to that is the human mind is not capable of knowing the supernatural. See, he's cut off the supernatural entirely from the discussion of what the Bible is, what religion is, or anything of the like. And so he, and this was published in 1999, by the way, so these things are still alive and well today. They are openly wanting to cut off any consideration of supernatural from the way the Bible was created, from the religion that we have, from our notion of history, or even how we relate in our own thinking abilities, right? Human autonomy, which a human autonomy can just be summarized as cognitive rebellion against the Lord, where instead of thinking the Lord's thoughts after him, we think our own thoughts after ourselves. And so these are kind of the things that are swimming in the air of these critical scholars. And they provide kind of the base presuppositions behind what happens when they approach books like the book of Isaiah. Another thing of positivism with its empirical scientific methods, it says that you can approach things unbiasedly, presuppositionless. And I think just, you know, thinking about these things very briefly as we had shows that presuppositionless investigation is a hoax.
Right.
And all of these views hold to certain theories about God, so they are theologically saturated, views about humanity and what we can do and who we are, things about history and how mankind came into being and how we came about today. And so this presuppositionless hermeneutic, you can say, that is often touted by critical scholars doesn't actually exist. And so we need to say that from the outset, because if you pick up their books, if you pick up, say, John Barton's Reading the Old Testament or anything like this, the language that they use is that if you just read the Bible intelligently, if you just come to it with an open mind, then lo and behold, you're going to come out a critical scholar. We laugh, but that's actually the kind of language that they use.
Yeah, if you approach the Bible via human reason, you're going to end up a critical scholar. I mean, it's rather naive to think that just approaching it with an open mind is approaching it without a set of presuppositions approaching it without a particular construct in mind.
One of the things to mention later is, it almost seems it's kind of academic arrogance, because it's saying, you know, finally in this modern era, we're intelligent enough to read the Bible intelligibly. The remarkable thing is that these sorts of views really didn't come into acceptance until post-Enlightenment, 1780s, and afterward, especially in the 19th century. So it seems to me, just in terms of that historical narrative, that it's pretty clear that the critical approaches to the Bible are a product of this post-Enlightenment modern empirical scientific thinking, rather than the product of simple intelligence. If you just approach it, it's hard to say, looking back over history, that the great minds of the past were unintelligent. You definitely don't want to say that. So the first response to this is actually to have a biblical view of what a prophet is. And a prophet is not that representation of a social or cultural phenomenon. A prophet is one among the people of God that the Lord calls, calls them up into the divine council, hears the voice of the Lord, and then carries that voice, carries that word of the Lord, the call out of my, back to the people. You're talking a little while ago about what Glenn, I think it was, is going to talk about, ascending the mountain of the Lord. Well, who provides a central paradigm for that in terms of prophetic communication in the Old Testament? It's Moses, who ascends the mountain of the Lord, hears the call out of Adonai, and then takes that voice back down the mountain and then provides that word to the people. And that's the prophetic paradigm. Think of Isaiah chapter 6. He's caught up into the heavenly mount, into the heavenly courtroom of God. He hears the voice of the Lord. He sees the throne room of God. And then it's from there that he comes back with his prophetic message. A number of good articles have been written on how virtually every theme, virtually all the content of the book of Isaiah is actually encapsulated in one way or another in Isaiah chapter 6. And I think that's an important aspect of what's going on there, where we actually see the prophet going into the heavenly presence of the Lord, and it's there that he receives his prophetic message from the Lord himself, and then is sent down with his covenant role of proclaiming the word of God and even the covenant lawsuits there to proclaim. And lest we cut off the importance of that ascending the mountain in order to receive the word of the Lord, Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 18. When he is responding to the false prophets, what is his response to them? Who among them has ascended the mountain of the Lord to hear the voice of the Lord? I think the initial response, the initial thing we need to let's look at here is that if you believe in the biblical conception of a prophet, then the critical views are cut off at the pass. And I think this is where you mentioned books earlier. I'll do another one. O.T. Elise, right? The Unity of Isaiah, published in 1950. It is dated, like you were saying, with Young's work. But what he does in his opening two chapters is he juxtaposes the critical conception of a prophet and the biblical conception of a prophet. And I think that's a good place to start because, and this, by the way, is how every prophet's class that I know of has been structured. Mine, as well as my students can testify,
yeah,
is more of a class on prophetism.
Mm.
Answering the question, what is a prophet? How does someone become a prophet? What do these prophets do? Rather than like a survey of prophetic books. So if you answer that question, then a lot of the concerns of critical scholars is cut off at the pass with a biblical conception of what a prophet is and what a prophet does.
Well, I was wondering if you could speak to us about, you know, what started to happen in the 1780s. You started to mention the Enlightenment, and we were talking about different approaches when critical scholarship really started to arise. I'm interested, perhaps at this point, especially for the listeners and viewers, to understand where typical divisions are among contemporary scholars. How do they see the book of Isaiah divided? What is a predominant critical view in terms of seeing different portions of the book, and how do they arrive at those particular conclusions?
Yeah, one of the things we can say is that predominant critical view doesn't actually exist. Every individual scholar is going to differ in a number of ways. There's general camps, and I'll talk about two of those here in a few minutes. There's general camps, but there is no consensus among critical scholars about how the book came into existence. But back to the beginning, what you're saying, and the first major movement toward considering Isaiah as coming from someone other than the prophet Isaiah happened in the 1780s with two guys, Doderlane and Eichhorn. And what Doderlane and Eichhorn did is they were reading the book of Isaiah, and they began to argue that there are two different historical horizons presented within the book. They would say that Isaiah 1 to 39, it has been termed Proto-Isaiah, presents an historical horizon of an Assyrian context, so the context of Isaiah's own life. However, what they term Deutero-Isaiah, chapters 40 to 66, they say presents a Babylonian context. And so the initial argumentation for a diversity of Isaianic authorship was that there are two different historical horizons for the book, one Assyrian, one Babylonian. And what they would say about that is that the second half of the book, Isaiah 40 to 66, does not predict. It does not look forward to the Babylonian exile in a Babylonian context. It assumes it. And so it says, since it does not predict the Babylonian exile, but assumes it, it had to have been written later, right? Because the Babylonian exile was after the time of Isaiah, thinking 586 here versus 740. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so these different horizons, they would say, is the initial assumption. And I think back to the historicism and things like that we're talking about before. So what they're saying is that, you know, a prophet has to be a reflection of their social and cultural context. And since the Assyrian context, you know, if Isaiah is in an Assyrian context, talking about Babylon doesn't reflect his historical context. And so if they're talking about Babylon, it has to come later when Babylon would have been a major world power when it was coming up against Judah and the southern kingdom there. So that view of a prophet who reflects society plays over into this, where they have to reflect their particular context. Now, there's two ironic points about this. One, Babylon is actually mentioned explicitly more times in Isaiah 1 to 39 than Isaiah 40 to 66. In Isaiah 1 to 39,
Babylon is mentioned 9 times explicitly. In Isaiah 40 to 66, he's mentioned twice. Babylon's mentioned twice. So 1 to 39, I think, has a pretty clear Babylonian message as well, especially Isaiah 13 and 14 and the prophecy, again, the oracle against the nation of Babylon. Now, later critical scholars have a response to that. They'd say it was redacted and added later. But we're in the 1780s, right? So this was the initial perspective, that 1 to 39 presented in a Syrian context, and then 40 to 66 Babylonian one. So after they began arguing this way, they began to look at these two books, Proto and Deutero Isaiah, and they began to say, and scholars shortly after them, that these two halves reflect two different theological perspectives. So the two historical horizons have two different theological views. For example, in Isaiah 1 to 39, there's a lot of discussion about this royal figure from the line of David, Isaiah chapter 11, who is going to redeem the people, Emmanuel, in Isaiah 7 to 9. However, in the second half of the book, 40 to 66, they would say that a royal figure, Emmanuel figure, is replaced with a servant figure. And so they would say these two provide two different theological portraits of the book. One a servant, one a servant, the other a king. Another one is they would say that the first half of the book, chapters 1 to 39, has a particular emphasis on the holiness of the Lord, whereas 40 to 66 has a particular emphasis on the universal dominion of the Lord. So I don't know about you, when I read Isaiah 2 and the discussion of the day of the Lord there, I fail to see how that's not universal. and you know, and the same thing, you know, in terms of what's in Isaiah 40 to 66, there's tons of discussion about the holiness of the Lord. And even in terms of the servant versus royal figure, the servant of the Lord and the royal redeemer in the first part of the book are actually discussed in very similar ways. I mentioned Isaiah 11 a minute ago in terms of, you know, Isaiah 11, 1 and 2 talks about a root and a shoot, you know, springing forth from David. And it, you know, springs to mind something that comes up in Isaiah 53 on how the suffering servant is one who does what? Who shoots forth from dry ground. Actually, the exact same term is used there in terms of the shoot springing forth. So I think that, you know, in terms of those brief things, the servant figure is the royal figure. Mm-hmm. The suffering servant of Isaiah 53 just further explains the way that this royal son is going to come forth. And it's going to come forth not in terms of, you know, victory, march, and glory, but in humiliation and suffering. Which, by the way, you know, the royal figure actually comes back just a few verses later after Isaiah 53 and Isaiah 55, where the everlasting covenant is established with the son of David. So all of these things go together there. And that, a third and final thing that they begin to do is say that the different theology, the different historical horizons also represent a different vocabulary, a different syntax, and different parts of the book. I think this discussion, this third one, has been rendered quite dubious by both sides here. as I mentioned quite a while ago now, the recognizing how Isaiah's ministry covered 40 years of his life, and his book reflects that as well, is enough to show that there would be changes in topic, changes in vocabulary. Or even that there is a change in genre. You know, Isaiah 1 to 39 has a lot of historical narrative type stuff in it. Isaiah 40 to 66 is almost entirely poetic and lyrical. But a change in genre has a change in syntax and a change in vocabulary as well. Interesting thing, too, that has happened since the advent of computers in the 1980s. There were a number of, you know, statistical linguistic studies on the book of Isaiah. One prominent example is by a guy named Radday, R-A-D-D-A-Y. And if you read his introduction, so he did this computer statistical study on Isaiah. You read his introduction, he's saying, statistical analysis shows that Isaiah came from different authors. And you can hear the critical school getting excited. And then you read the main content of his analysis, and it doesn't actually reflect any of the divisions that the critical scholars proposed. So the statistical analysis, the computer statistical analysis, actually went against the breakdown that the critical schools were arguing for. So, for example, Rade believed and concluded in terms of his statistical analysis that Isaiah 49 to 66 reflected the same vocabulary and syntax. And that doesn't sound much like Proto and Deutero Isaiah from Doderling and Eichhorn. Another significant development about 100 years after them, so 1890s now. In 1892, Bernard Doom published his commentary on Isaiah, where we are introduced to a third figure that he terms Treato Isaiah. So Doom looks at this, at the book, and he says, well, actually, Isaiah 56 to 66 seems to reflect a different context as well. So Doom comes along and says, sure, there's a proto-Isaiah, Isaiah 1 to 39, a deutero-Isaiah, Isaiah 40 to 55, but there's also a Treato Isaiah 56 to 66.
And that just means first, second, and third for people from the Greek.
Yeah. First Isaiah, second Isaiah, and third Isaiah going through there. And some clarification on that front. Don't see these as individuals. It's not like there is an original individual Isaiah, then a second person coming up on the persona of Isaiah, and then a third one doing the same thing. It's much more common to see these as phases of a redaction with any sort of unknown number of scribes, redactors, individuals, editors going back and changing some of these things.
Kind of like Franklin W. Dixon.
Yeah.
Does anyone know who that is? He's the supposed author of the Hardy Boys, but those are written by maybe dozens, if not hundreds of people. They just slapped a name on the book so it looks like a single author did it.
Yeah.
Authorship by committee.
And it's a similar thing here. In fact, it's been quite explicit.
I might have just broken the hearts of many, the boyhood hearts of many people out there who love the Hardy Boys novels. Anyway, that's typical. So it isn't the idea that there was some Isaianic office occupied by individuals successively, like Pharaoh. Well, how many pharaohs were there? A lot of them. It's not like there's the prophet position Isaiah, like you're Bishop of Rome or something, and there's a succession of them, but rather these eras or stages of composition and editing.
Yeah. Yeah. And even those stages are seen differently by some. So nowadays it's become common, especially among evangelicals, to see a sort of Isaianic school. And what they mean by that is like they would hold to a traditional person, Isaiah, in the 8th century, and he had a school of disciples, and his disciples were the ones that collected his book and passed down a tradition that was then edited, updated, added to, until finally we have a couple centuries later, the book of Isaiah.
So like graduate assistants.
Yeah, a bunch of TAs.
TAs doing your research for you. And to say, when you get your TAs, then you can put your name on the book.
There we go. That's pretty accurate.
And that's why it's funny, right?
And I think that's important. So what these sort of phases of redaction do, what they say is that there's two things functioning side by side in the way that the book of Isaiah grows. And those two things are redaction and then a fun German word called Fortschreibung, right? Fortschreibung. Redactive elements are large-scale additions to an earlier version. So think the Oracle Against Babylon, Isaiah 13, would have been a redactional element added on. But far more prominent in the discussions of scholars is that other fun German word I mentioned a moment ago. You have to mention it in German because the German language has this remarkable ability of combining concepts that don't translate all that well.
Very synthetic.
And the concept contained within that word is that the progress of writing is where earlier prophetic messages were read and then sort of organically interwoven into new prophetic messages. So it's not just like new things were added on, like a copy and paste job. They would have some things like that. But also they were interwoven together in this process as a fortschritt in order to kind of make it a more coherent book, to smooth out the edges, if you will. And so it's these two things working side by side in a highly complex and I'll say even dizzying array to lead to the book of Isaiah as we have it today. And I say complex and dizzying because literally any individual scholar that you read will have a different view on various passages.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that's across the board. A little bit of irony there that after 250 years of intelligent reading, it has not been rendered intelligible. So two of the prominent theories that have been produced on this I have two representative guys that I like to look at. One is Odile Steck, a German guy. Another guy, Jacob Stromberg. Steck is a bit older, mid-20th century. And his view on how Isaiah came into being was that there were two original collections, First Isaiah and Second Isaiah, that existed independent of one another. And then as time went on, Second Isaiah, Deutero-Isaiah, kind of formed the core of the book of Isaiah as we know it today. So we're thinking 40 to 45 with a number of extraneous elements left out, forming the core of the book of Isaiah. And then over time, after a number of phases, the Treato-Isaiah kind of school or individual scribes, whatever you want to call it, kind of came in and brought the earlier Proto-Isaiah and joined it together to Deutero-Isaiah in a number of phases and then added everything onto it. And it just kept growing until finally, toward the end of the Hellenistic era, we have a complete, great book of Isaiah, a Grozesha book, as Steck would call it. So this is one pretty prominent general theory that is focused on Deutero-Isaiah and then has Treato-Isaiah in a number of different phases, which themselves encompass a couple of centuries from the exile into the Hellenistic era, kind of coming back and incorporating Proto-Isaiah into Deutero-Isaiah and adding Treato-Isaiah in a number of phases there. So that's, in the 5-second version. And his view there. Very prominent today among German critical scholars, very popular view. But again, they'll take the general notion of Deutero-Isaiah primacy, Proto added to it later by Treato-Isaiah, and then that general discussion renders a lot of different results when looking at particular texts. A second one by a guy named Jacob Stromberg. Stromberg is much more recent. I think his dissertation on this was published in 2011, 2012. So in the Academic Guild yesterday. And Stromberg's thesis is that this process of redaction and fortschritt progresses in terms of Proto, Deutero, and Treato Isaiah 1, 2, and 3. And so we have this sort of original core, original Isaianic core, that then grows over time and tradition and progresses among the three books. So his is slightly different, a little more complex, but those are kind of two representative models on how scholars are thinking that these things are coming together. But notice that they're very different. They're very different in where the origins of the book comes from. One thinks the origin is in 1 to 39, generally, and the other in 40 to 55, generally. So it's very different in terms of how these things come together. It's different in the particulars of various passages. Just a brief story here. I was actually trying to chronicle a handout for my class about, what scholars are saying in terms of what passage goes with which Isaiah, and I promptly gave up. Because, you know, there's the general things like Isaiah 13 belonging somewhere in the Babylonian era. But beyond that, you know, it's so diverse that it's almost impossible to keep track of, you know, every scholar saying every different thing.
Yeah. Now, Will, I'm wondering if you could speak just, briefly about some conservative responses to some of the critical views, maybe before we start to tie things up. But before that, I'm curious, what happened to the critical school once some of the Qumran scrolls were discovered? I know that kind of dumped some of their theories on their head. They found old editions of the prophet Isaiah that were not, you know, traditionally divided the way they thought they might be.
Yeah, so the discovery of the Qumran scrolls did a couple of things. One, so before the 1950s and the discovery of them, I think it was actually 1948.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, for people who might not know, the Caves of Qumran, correct?
Yeah. So before that, the final composition of Isaiah was pushed all the way forward to about 100 BC by some of the more critical scholars. So that's very late. And they pretty much said that because it had to be done, you know, before the New Testament came around. Otherwise, they'd probably do it even later than that. However, here comes this discovery of the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then we have a scroll designated 1Q Isaiah A. And it's called the Great Isaiah Scroll. And it is a complete scroll of the book of Isaiah discovered in these caves from the Qumran community that is dated. Carbon dating actually has a date range here between about 341 and 114 BC.
Wow.
And so it depends on, you know, how, you know, I don't know anything about carbon dating. I just know, you know, different methods have rendered, you know, a date range.
And they have to, those constantly get updated too, because they have to calibrate them. And I know that there would be many people out there that have read and understood that, but it's an interesting field, but it's not, it's scientific, but I think matters are much more complex than we as a scientific community understand at the moment. So there's constant adjustment.
Into interpretation.
Well, and when they find, they can find, just for the sake of, you know, discussion, they might find discover an old tree somewhere that they didn't know before that's older than the previous old tree. This is super, super general, but then that might help them because of the rings on a tree to go back and understand the amount of carbon 14 and different rings of the tree by which you can recalibrate the dates. So depending on the year carbon dating scholarship was written, those particular dates might not be adjusted, so they can flex years before, years afterward, and then it's beyond me because I'm no geologist or chemist. So, but I understand in general terms how they're doing it, how it works. I don't know.
So in terms of our work, we're reporting, and the report is somewhere between 340 and about 115 BC. This great Isaiah scroll was written, and it's a complete Isaiah scroll containing chapters 1 to 66. That really throws a wrench into the thesis that parts of it weren't written until 100, or even into the Hellenistic period, because all of a sudden we have this scroll that's complete smack dab in the middle of the Hellenistic period. And, you know, just a little date here too. The close of the Old Testament canon is probably somewhere around 500 to 475, with the writing of Malachi. And so we're talking, you know, 150 years after the close of the Old Testament canon. That is really close in terms of historical artifacts and what we have in this dating. And then in terms of, you know, division, so we talk about the Great Isaiah Scroll. There's actually a lot of different scrolls on Isaiah that we have. So there's 1Q Isaiah B, 4Q Isaiah B, C, and E are all fairly full Isaiah scrolls, none of which reflect a division where the critical scholars propose the divisions.
Yeah, like there's no superscription at the beginning of chapter 40 on any of these, even though every other scholar or every other prophet, to my knowledge, has a superscription at the beginning.
Yeah. So none of that's there. In fact, they all sort of reflect a unity of the book of Isaiah. The closest that comes to it is in the great Isaiah scroll. There's a couple line break between Isaiah 33 and Isaiah 34. And so some have taken that and they've proposed what they call the Bifid approach to Isaiah, which they break it in half at Isaiah 33 and say there's, you know, 33 chapters here, 33 chapters there. However, I think Emmanuel Tove has argued fairly convincingly that that break is just a change in scribe. So it's just, you know, one scribe finished writing, another scribe came up. So it's not a structural element, and it's also not reflected in any of the other scrolls that we have.
It's particular to that specific copy.
Right.
I get it. Yeah. Well, sure, you do like that. I do that in my own journal. You know, if I'm writing, you know, or Truman would say my diary, if I was writing in my diary, you know,
writing about your journey.
Yeah. I do that on Instagram, Will. But I would right. Well, so, you know, you'd have the date and I start, but if I write something in the morning or in the evening, I don't necessarily redate it, but I put a few lines in between and I kind of can go back and realize, I don't know, maybe that's a bad example. Sometimes I think we just don't, the critical scholars, or even not critical scholars, just scholars, we don't think about these prophets as real people. You know, let's just think about how a person works. Think about your own life. I mean, none of this stuff has to be super mysterious, you know?
Yeah. And so he asked about particular responses. I jotted down 7 here to go over quickly.
Sure, let's do it.
I feel like every time I'm on our episodes,
we just got to come back more frequently. We're in no rush. We can get through the material in other episodes too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm curious to know what some of these responses are, especially in light of, you know, an orthodox doctrine of scripture.
Yeah. So the first response, which critical scholars were kind of hate, but I think it's an important one, is the theological response. The irony is, you know, if you're reading, pick up Jacob Stromberg's book on Isaiah, about page 2, he's like, some people don't, you know, accept the diversity of Isaianic scholarship. And he kind of writes them off saying, for theological reasons. Well, I think theological reasons are pretty good reasons.
Right, but that goes back to the presupposition of that dividing line or dividing wall between biblical studies and theological studies. Yeah. Where they would want us, there are many people that have this idea, well, we study the Bible on the Bible's own terms and we don't bring any theological construct to it. We just go where we go. But that, you know, we've discussed in the past of why that's an illegitimate pursuit. But that's what's behind this view.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're very clear about it. For example, Semler, you know, kind of the early historical critical school guy, you know, he would say, I'm here to discuss religion, not theology.
Right.
What he meant by that is, like, we're not talking about the dogmatic aspect at all. All we're concerned about is that historicist approach to the Bible.
Right.
And that's still alive and well today.
Mm-hmm.
And so the theological argument, you know, this is kind of what we've been doing the whole time. Where the biblical view of what a prophet is, the biblical view of how the Bible came into being, undercuts at its core this critical method, this critical approach. And, you know, one thing, you know, Richard Schultz, Old Testament scholar, who's pretty prominent for defending the unity of Isaiah from the current conservative perspective, he has a pretty good analogy where he says, after he's reflected some on these critical schools, that it seems like the critical approach to Isaiah is like scratches on a camera lens, where it produces rather than discovers the breaks in the text. And so, you know, the image, you know, if you have a scratch on a lens, any picture that you take is going to have that scratch in it. And I think that's pretty an accurate description of their work. They have these presuppositions in place. And now everything they're going to do is going to reflect on those things. And so what we need to do is have a biblical foundation, you know, a biblical view of inerrancy and what the prophets are there to do in receiving the word of the Lord and carrying it to his people. And if you have that, then a lot of their considerations are easily dealt with. Now, the downside to Stromberg and the critical deal is to say they just have theological reasons. It's like, yeah, we have theological reasons. So do you. But we want to, we also have reasons looking at the text. We have theological reasons and we have reasons as we're looking at it. So if you're looking at the text of Isaiah, numerous times, especially in the first half of the book, Isaiah is mentioned as the explicit originator of this prophetic message. Isaiah 1:1, Isaiah 2:1, Isaiah 13:1, Isaiah chapter 20, verse 2, 31, verses 6 and 7. You know, all of these places, Isaiah is explicitly mentioned as the one from whom this prophetic message comes. So if you are, they would say there's some sort of, pious fraud or something like that. The unity of Isaiah view, I think, is really the only one that takes those superscriptions seriously and takes the text as it stands seriously, because as we were saying earlier, there is no other superscription in the book. There is no other, thus says the Isaianic school,
right,
passing on this tradition. Now, another thing, especially in terms of Isaiah 13:1, that's the introduction to the oracle against the nations, and especially the one against Babylon. So Isaiah 13:1 says explicitly that this oracle concerning Babylon comes from the historical person Isaiah. And so to counter that, I think, does violence to the text. So the one Isaiah view is the only one that takes the claims of the text seriously as coming from the prophet Isaiah himself. So that's reason number two out of our perfect seven. Number three is a thematic and literary unity to the book. Here's what I mean by that. Thematic unity is that the book of Isaiah expresses a lot of the same themes in a lot of the same ways throughout every aspect of the book. One of the most prominent themes in the book of Isaiah, the Holy One of Israel, occurs about 30 times in the book. I think it only occurs 36 times in the entire Old Testament, so it's a key theme for the prophet Isaiah. And it occurs evenly distributed in each of the proposed sections. So each section has an emphasis on the holiness of the Lord, just as each section has an emphasis on the Lord controlling whatsoever comes to pass, having a universal dominion, all of these sorts of things. Another prominent theme in the book of Isaiah is a theme of judgment unto restoration, where the road to salvation for the prophet Isaiah is through the judgment of the exile. Another way that this is expressed is suffering unto restoration, exile unto restoration, or even humiliation unto glorification. And in fact, the entire book of Isaiah kind of reflects this transition from humiliation to exaltation. If you're looking at the initial parts of the book, the proclamation against Israel in chapters 1 to 5, their sin, the historical situations detailed beginning in chapter 7 into chapter 39, and how Israel is continuously apostate. And then you get to the end of the book, and it has this beatific vision, you could say, about the new heavens and the new earth. And so, like, the whole book is structured as kind of a suffering unto exaltation structure. And if you lose any part, then you miss that flow of the book. And this is even seen in the divisions where the prophetic or the critical scholars talk about. So Isaiah 39, and we're delving into literary stuff here. Isaiah 38-39 begins a transition from the Assyrian attack from Sennacherib toward a new context of envoys coming from Babylon that Hezekiah shows the wealth of the temple to, that produces the context for Babylon coming later and invading Judah. The important point I want to draw here, so critical scholars say there's a division between Isaiah 39 and Isaiah 40, but I want to say Isaiah 40 doesn't make any sense without Isaiah 39. So literarily, if you just cut that out and you're in Isaiah 37, then this context of the Lord miraculously and his great power saving Judah from the hand of Sennacherib doesn't produce a context literarily to then have Isaiah 41, comfort, comfort my people, says your God. What does? The prophesied Babylonian exile, right? So Isaiah 39 provides the context for everything that happens in Isaiah 40 to 66 and that, you know, Babylonian perspective that comes forward. And it's rooted in an historical context from Isaiah's own day in terms of the Babylonian envoys coming. Another thing on that front, a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, is for critical scholars to say that a forward-looking perspective doesn't have anything to say to an earlier context. I'm preaching regularly at a church here, and I think they could testify that every sermon that I preach says something about the new heavens and the new earth, something about a forward-looking perspective.
Good.
And I think that's immensely practical for the people today. And it would have been for the people in Isaiah's day, too, because what he's talking about is that their failure to repentance is going to lead to the pouring out of the covenant curses. And he's constantly calling them to repentance and to righteousness and to justice, all key themes of the book of Isaiah, throughout its entirety. So the forward-looking perspective toward Babylon and the Babylonian exile fits perfectly the historical context of the prophet Isaiah himself, if we take his stuff seriously.
Yeah.
Fourth, textual history. There is not a single manuscript tradition, we talked about this already, so we'll do it briefly, that reflects divisions like the critical scholars want to say. And I think this is important, especially if you consider other manuscript traditions, like pertaining to the book of Jeremiah, that do reflect different orderings and different divisions in the book. That's maybe a future episode that we can do and talk
so
about.
So maybe it's a little more complicated dealing with the prophet Jeremiah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the point I want to make here is that if there were different editions, the situation of the textual history of Jeremiah says that there would not have been an issue in passing on both editions simultaneously. And that's not what we see with the prophet Isaiah. With the prophet Isaiah, we don't see two different editions or three different editions or 40 different editions being passed down. We see one. And so textual history provides a key element to what's going on here as well. And by the way, we should say the division in the textual history of Jeremiah is reflected in the book of Jeremiah itself. So there are good biblical discussions to have about that. Reason number five, as we're drawing to a close here, is New Testament citations.
This is huge to me. Yeah, you know, when you start to look at the unity of Scripture.
Yeah, and if you only looked at explicit New Testament citations, just explicit ones that say something to the effect of from the prophet Isaiah, every section of the book from every proposed compiler or editor of phase is attributed to the prophet Isaiah. So the New Testament, including Jesus, holds to an Isaic authorship. You know, Beale mentions, I know it's in Erosion of Inerrancy, I'm not sure if it is in the article, that if you don't hold the unity of Isaiah, you begin to have a Christological issue where Jesus is either incorrect or lying. I don't think we really want to go there, do we?
No.
You know, the way the New Testament reads the book of Isaiah is the New Testament testifies to a united Isaiah. And that becomes even more significant if you include not merely citations, but also allusions, which is just a massive number of allusions and things throughout.
Yeah, that intertextuality of Isaiah is everywhere, especially when you start to study it in the original language, you start to see that.
Oh, yeah.
And even in the Septuagint, start to see the usage of the prophet all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Isaiah is the most cited prophet in the New Testament, and it's expansive. Coupled with that is some of my own work. This is an argument not as prominent among evangelicals, but I think it's just as important. And it's the use of Isaiah, not in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament. So already in pre-exilic prophets, you find allusions to the book of Isaiah that critical scholars say come from after the time of Isaiah. So for example, I believe there's an allusion to Isaiah 53, 9 and Zephaniah 3:13. Part of my dissertation work there, where the suffering servant is described as one who has a pure mouth, has clean lips. And then, that same phrase is used in Zephaniah 3:13 to talk about the people that the Lord comes and redeems. Same thing, and actually in Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 7, there's an allusion to Isaiah chapter 13, verse 3. Both of those passages, which critical scholars think comes after the time of Zephaniah, where Zephaniah, who's writing in the time of Josiah, actually alludes to these very passages. And that can be expanded. There's allusions in Habakkuk. One other thing, there's actually an article written on Zephaniah by John Onn, A-H-N, entitled Zephaniah, a Disciple of Isaiah? Where he actually elucidates, or he begins to argue that perhaps Zephaniah's prophetic message actually comes from some reading of the prophet Isaiah.
How would you see Micah 4's usage? It's almost verbatim, Micah 4 and Isaiah 2, that prophecy.
Very similar thing. Another example of this sort of, interbiblical working here. Where, these, the prophets especially allude to other places in the Old Testament, but Isaiah in the minor prophets is a particularly prominent one. Amos does it, Micah does it, Zephaniah does it, Habakkuk does it. It's a very prominent tool that they use in reflecting on the prophet Isaiah for their own prophetic messages.
Yeah.
That's one that could use a little more drawing out in terms of the evangelical discussion. Another one that I've never heard anybody else argue for. So this one, that previous one, I know E.J. Young has mentioned some similar things to it prior to the whole intertextuality discussion. So it's not new, but it's also not prominent. This one, I think, is new, and I don't know if anyone else has argued it. And it's the relationship of the Book of the 12 thesis to the prophet Isaiah and what critical scholars are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who don't know, a pretty prominent field right now takes the 12 minor prophets and says the 12 minor prophets is a single book, one book, composed of 12 individual books written by a series of different authors, the 12 different prophets, if you're a conservative like me. And so if you're thinking about that, as a possible thesis, there's still disagreement on it. And what we have is a single book, the Book of the 12, written by multiple authors, 12 different authors, over a course of centuries, which pretty much matches, the time of Isaiah toward a post-exilic period in Malachi. So Hosea to Malachi there. If that's the case, then the Book of the 12 actually provides a paradigm or a sort of genre, if you will, about how a book could have been written with multiple authors over the course of centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the Book of the 12 thesis is the case, then we also need to pose the question is why doesn't the Book of Isaiah reflect that? Why doesn't the Book of Isaiah reflect a writing convention that would have been available to that time frame to express multiple authors over the course of centuries? That it doesn't, I think, is evidence that he doesn't use that writing convention. The book doesn't reflect that writing convention. Therefore, a unity of Isaiah is a good conclusion.
Right.
That's a complex topic that we can talk about at another time.
Sure, let's do it.
The final one, so this one is the lesser one, the history of interpretation, where over the centuries, with only very minor exceptions, prior to the Enlightenment, the Book of Isaiah was treated as a unity. That, I say it's minor in terms of we're talking about non-inspired authors looking at this sort of thing, but it does show that for almost 2,000 years, 2,000 years, right? 740 to 1780, for, over 2,000 years, it was read as a single unit. And it really reinforces what Schultz was saying about it being a production of the critical lens rather than an intelligent reading of the book.
Yeah. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I like the seven responses. I think they remove the power that the critical reading it undermines it effectively. At the end of the day,
right.
We come back to what we opened the discussion with, and that is the four principles of critical scholarship. And the big one, of course, the summary of that is the influence of philosophical presuppositions that are learned from other sources. Auguste Comte, for instance, is the father of modern sociology. The study of sociology. He's also classified as a historian of sorts, and influenced by philosophical currents himself. And so these come into the biblical studies field, and it's amazing how many biblical scholars don't even think about that.
Yeah,
because that's verboten. But I appreciate what Will has done here. And there's more that could be said. You know, you could break down each of those 7 points responses and deal in further depth as you would want to over time.
Yeah. Well, let's stay locked in, and perhaps very soon we can continue on through the lecture looking at some of the other material. I'm looking at the covenant lawsuit material that I would love to speak about, but there's also many other issues regarding different types of criticism, form criticism. You know, for example, we didn't speak too much about the different approaches that have been used in the past. It's always helpful to review that sort of thing and help us get our head screwed on correctly. But nevertheless, it's been a very full and enjoyable conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today, Will. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Yeah, we really appreciate it. Stay cool down in Atlanta, because it's about
we'll try. It's hot.
deathly humid at the moment, I hear. Things are all right here in Illinois, and I imagine things in Philadelphia area are also pretty good. But regardless, wherever we may be, we're thankful that we can connect and we can discuss these different things regarding Reformed theology and most importantly, just speaking about God's Word and trying to understand it better. So we do encourage people to visit us online at reformedforum.org. If you head on over there, you'll find information about all of our programs and events. And again, stay in touch with us either through the email newsletter or just checking the website for news and updates. You can also follow us on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, all the typical social places. We try to keep up and keep things posted and keep things moving there. But we do, of course, want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.